This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to the Woman's Hour podcast for Thursday, the 4th of June. Good morning. As the restrictions of lockdown begin to ease a little, what's the position for those considered extremely clinically vulnerable to COVID-19? Women with such disabilities have been shielded, which means not leaving your home for any reason. How are they finding the experience and what support have they had? And the next of our troopers, the women who see a need and fill it. Today, it's Mari McLean and the voluntary work she's been doing for her small Highland community. Earlier this week, a march protesting the death of Uwala Omazuwa was held in the Nigerian city of Benin. Uwa's rape and murder has caused outrage across the country. She was 22, a microbiology student, and she was found last week in a church she'd been using as a quiet place to study. She was rushed to hospital after the attack, but died last Saturday. Hashtag justice for Uwa, hashtag stop raping women have been trending on Twitter and have been followed by the names of other victims of sexual violence. It's estimated some 2 million Nigerian women and girls are sexually assaulted every year, but few of those cases are reported, let alone prosecuted. What needs to be done to prevent such violence against women in the country? Osai Ojigo is Amnesty International's director in Nigeria and joins us from there. Osai, what exactly happened to Uwa?
Uwa had gone to study at a church where she's also a member of the choir, and she was discovered in a pool of her blood and taken to a hospital. This was last week on Wednesday. So it was while they were still treating her for assault wounds, because they thought it was a sort of robbery or theft, they now discovered she was also sexually violated. And that was when the outrage really gained momentum, because it was clear she was violently raped. And then in order to hide their crime, the perpetrators hit her on the head with a fire extinguisher in order to silence her. She died sadly on Saturday. And the news of her death really resonated amongst a lot of us who have been working under COVID to raise the government's response to sexual and gender-based its interventions in the country.
We know, as I said, that other victims' names have appeared on social media, so there are more victims of sexual attack that have happened recently. Who are they?
Yes, we have Jennifer, which happened in the northwest part of the country, a young girl that was raped allegedly by four men. There's a case of a 12-year-old girl who hasn't been named because she's a minor and who was allegedly gang raped by 11 men in Jigawa in northwest Nigeria as well. And also other cases are emerging, the most recent being a student who was at home as a result of COVID in Ibadan in southwest Nigeria, who was raped and then starved to death in her home. So we're seeing series of these attacks coming out in the open as the government is easing down the lockdown.
Now, I know that Amnesty has said that the government response has been negligible. Why have you said negligible?
Because they're not prioritizing the issues of sexual and gender-based violence against women. In fact, we were shocked that in Uwa's case, the police statement was that they were investigating a murder. They've been silent in their statements in referring to it as both a rape and a murder. And it goes to the fact that there's this apathy amongst police officers that they cannot successfully investigate and prosecute rape cases. And so as much as possible, there's a tendency for them to neglect victims and their families when they come to report, and instead convince them to drop the cases or to find some ways to gain compensation from the alleged rapists and their family. So this is a worrying trend.
And yet, we did hear from the Lagos State Domestic and Sexual Violence Response Team, and they told us that 90 convictions were secured last year for rape victims. Are things improving?
I think that there have been a few cases like that when they come into the public foray, they do get attention. But 19 cases in a state like Lagos, where there's over 20 million inhabitants, is literally a drop in the ocean. And a lot more needs to be done to address it. And because the system is so slow, they cannot catch up with the number of cases that comes up every day. And that is what is shocking.
We've also been told that very few women are prepared to report their sexual attacks. Why might that be?
Majorly because of stigmatization. They are afraid that they wouldn't be believed. People tend to ask them where they were, what they were doing, what hour of the day the incident happened. And so it kind of challenges society's view about piety for girls. So they feel that coming out would be shaming themselves and their family. And that's why it's really important to raise awareness that the law enforcement especially and medical practitioners that are the first point of call when rape victims are sent there are not shamed for sharing their story.
What forensic testing is available for those who do report? Because we've also read that it's very difficult to get forensic testing done, and sometimes women are expected to pay for it themselves.
Yes, that's a big challenge. Rape kits were developed some time back in order to support the investigation and documentation of sexual crimes. But you find that not every police station and not every government hospital has those rape kits. And as a result of that, things are done quite ad hoc, or they make do with whatever they have. And then preserving the evidence is also quite challenging. And this has also contaminated some of the materials that the police have used in order to prosecute the case. The police are underfunded, and they tend to ask victims and their families for what they call mobilization fees, basically to cover transportation, to cover visits to the hospital, as well as something as simple as paper and pen in order to file the complaint. So it's a multitude of challenges that rape victims face when they try to seek justice.
We know that last year a sex offenders register was launched. What difference has that made?
I think it's still too early to test the sex offenders register, but it was a welcome development. The reality now is that there was a lot of awareness that if you are caught and you are convicted, you will get into the register. And it actually brought about a lot of debate. And across the country, we know that many people are now more fearful about being on the sex offenders register than being caught, because they realize it has long-lasting effects. But it's still too early to see what the impact would be and whether it would be as effective, and independent as we want it to be.
Oh, so, Osayo Jigo, thank you so much for being with us this morning and explaining what's been happening in Nigeria. Thank you. We did, of course, try to contact the Nigerian government and ask for a statement on their intentions. So far, we've received no response. There are links on the Women's Hour website to organisations that can help in cases of sexual violence. And also, thank you so much. Now, still to come in today's programme, lockdown for women with a disability. What support is available for those who've been shielding because of extreme clinical vulnerability? And the serial, the 9th episode of A Run in the Park. On Tuesday's programme next week, we'll be looking at the first UK study of violence against grandparents. If you are a grandparent and you've suffered in this way, we would really like to hear from you. What triggered the violent behaviour? What support have you had? And what kind of reaction have you had from the police if you reported the problem? Please do get in touch with us through the website. And of course, we won't name you if you don't want us to. And now the next in our series celebrating the women who get things done, the troopers. Marie MacLean was born in the village of Murrah in the Scottish Highlands. If you're familiar with the film Local Hero, Murrah is where it was shot. Marie lived away from the village for a while, not far away, but around 20 years ago she went back and found some of the things on which the community had depended were past their best or had gone altogether. We heard about Marie from Alison Stewart, who was keen that her friend's volunteering work should be recognised. We'll hear from Alison in a little while, but first, Marie.
It's a very small village, some 200 people, at the end of a very remote peninsula, 40 miles away. It was bypassed probably about 25 to 30 years ago, and as a consequence of that, the post office closed, the tourist traffic declined, and eventually the village hall fell into disrepair.
At this point, the Skype line that I was talking to Mari on began to crackle badly. We switched to the phone.
Mari, hi.
Hello.
So, Mora, it has a film claim to fame, doesn't it?
Oh, it does, yes. Local Hero was filmed in the area quite some time ago, probably in the 80s, I think.
You're going to Scotland, McIntyre?
Yes, sir.
The old country.
So the area is famous for its
beautiful beaches.
White sand beaches, right?
And it's actually an extremely picturesque area. And of course, Murrah also has the UK's deepest lake, or loch as we call them, Loch Murrah. So we have the deepest loch, we have the finest beaches, we have a few redeeming features.
All these lovely natural redeeming features aside, there was something that the town of Murrah was sorely lacking.
Across the whole peninsula, there wasn't really a full-size playing field for football or shinty as is played here in the Highlands. So it's a Highland, or Scottish, I should say, game with a stick, rather like hockey, when you live in a remote area with a very low population density. If you want to raise the competitive bar in sport, you really do have to think about encouraging young people from elsewhere to come and play on the field.
The bypass that cut Murrah off from tourist traffic and cost the village its post office has been the villain of the story up until this point. But when it comes to the playing field, it did have one surprising opportunity to offer.
When the bypass was constructed, it led to an piece of land being reclaimed from the sea, which was designated as being suitable for a playing field. It was a rough piece of land. It was left just as the contractors had left it. So the village got together and fundraised and created a playing field out of it. Because the village hall had become derelict and had asbestos problems, it was decided it needed changing rooms, showers, that sort of thing.
Am I right in thinking all the people of Murrah want is a sports field that they can access?
That's right.
And given that this is Scotland and not the Bahamas, somewhere where the players and children can get changed into their kit?
Yes, exactly. It's actually impossible really to take young children to a playing field that doesn't even have as much as a toilet.
Simple enough, you'd think, but of course, the story didn't end there.
In the fundraising process for that, we discovered that the access road to the playing field had been built on land that didn't belong to the field. A land exchange had to occur before anything further could be done, and this has taken some 10 years to achieve.
You have worked on getting this playing field for your village up yes. and running. I mean, not alone, with others, but you have yes. worked on this for a decade.
And more, yes.
Okay, so more
from
than...
From the beginning, it's 20 years. And actually, I'm wrong. Prior to that, there was a group prior to me. So it's been ongoing for nearly 30 years, I think.
Can I ask you what it's like to work on a campaign for that long?
Well, it's a test of endurance, really. And there are always great supporters. Furthermore, we are a trust. We have a membership. A significant number of the villagers, probably about 90% of the villagers, are members. And they're generally very supportive.
So this was sent to me by Alison Stewart.
Yes.
I think you know Alison.
I do, yes.
She told me about you, and she said this.
One of Mary's real strengths, I think, is in identifying and securing appropriate pots of funding for local projects, something she is particularly good at. She is well aware of the need for communities to become increasingly proactive and do things for themselves. Otherwise, they're just not done at all. Yet, despite all of her community work, she is rarely in the spotlight. So I think it's time to put that right.
Are you feeling a little bit embarrassed?
Or... Yes. Please, indeed.
Do you foresee the facility being built at some point in the next, say, I don't know...
decade?
Yeah.
Yes, I do. I do indeed, yeah.
Why do you keep going?
Oh.
And how?
Determination. It's just what small communities do, what rural people all over the country actually do and struggle with all the time. Well, somebody has to do it.
Maureen McLean was talking to Laura Thomas. Most of us, I think, are beginning to breathe a slight sigh of relief as some of the restrictions of lockdown are eased. You can travel a bit further to see people, invite a couple of friends to your garden, and even go out to shop for something other than food or medicine. But for one large group of people, there is no such liberty on the horizon. They're people with medical conditions that make them extremely clinically vulnerable to COVID-19. They're shielded for a minimum of 12 weeks, which means they can't leave the house for any reason, not even for exercise or to get food. How are disabled women finding the experience, and what support are they getting? Well, Katie Pennick is a journalist and activist on the part of the disabled and uses a wheelchair herself. She's spoken to three other women in similar circumstances to hers. Katie first.
My name is Katie and I'm a 24-year-old disabled campaigner and journalist. I'm currently shielding and I haven't left my flat in North London at all for over 70 days. The government regulations and restrictions around lockdown are forever changing and can be quite confusing. Now we've been told that people who are shielding should continue to take precautions but can now leave their home if they wish, so long as they are able to maintain strict social distancing. I know for myself and for millions of others in a similar position, it still doesn't feel safe to leave the house. Today I am joined on a video call by three disabled women to find out how lockdown is impacting them and their day-to-day lives.
My name is Fee Anderson. I'm communications manager for a non-profit supporting parents with disabilities like myself called Enable to Parent. I'm also in the extremely high risk group and I'm shielding at home in Greater Manchester with my husband and two primary aged children.
Hello, my name is Cheryl Bajaya. I'm a public policy academic at UCL. I teach about the non-profit sector and leadership. I'm also shielding in the clinically high-risk group and I am at home in North London with my husband and my son, who are also shielding.
Hi, I'm Dr. Amy Kavanagh. I'm a visually impaired activist and campaigner. I am not shielding, but I am facing many challenges in accessing the world now that we're in the new normal.
Let's talk first about the immediate changes and impact that this has had. Fee, how has shielding affected the way that you organise and receive the care and support that you need?
Everything kind of went upside down the day lockdown came into effect. Suddenly I had all these extra responsibilities to do with my personal assistants. I, of course, had my two children at home all of a sudden, and trying to juggle my care needs was challenging in the beginning until we got into a routine. Some of my PAs were afraid to come in because nobody knew kind of what they were doing. And we weren't really given any instructions. I'm on a scheme called Direct Payments where I self-manage my own care with a budget given to me by social care. And we didn't get any kind of instructions until about 2 weeks ago on what to do with our personal assistants, which are, you know, the carers, which should have really been grouped in with the whole support that they were given to care homes and things like that. Carers out in the community kind of got forgotten about.
I mean, before lockdown, what help did your carers provide? How many hours did you get and how has that changed?
My package is 33 hours a week. But yeah, it's kind of made it so I can only have two PAs rather than a team of four.
And this issue on PPE, how does that work? Who provides the PPE?
For people on direct payments, we are told to source them ourselves. You're not given any instruction on what kind of brands of masks and things you're supposed to provide your personal assistants with, whether they need to be the same grade as NHS workers working with COVID patients directly, or whether they can, you know, be okay with like a plain old surgical mask. We were just told your PAs must have PPE and you need to sort it and pay for it yourself, which was very, very stressful because obviously I care a lot about the people coming in and out of my home. And it's my responsibility at the end of the day, being on direct payments, to make sure they're safe as well as ourselves. So the direct payments documentation that came out about 2 weeks ago says that anybody who's on a ventilator, which I am at night, their PAs need to be fully gowned up. And I'm talking about aprons, face shield, the whole shebang. And if you can imagine, I've got young children and, you know, it's not been possible yet for PAs to come in wearing all this. But can you imagine how intimidating that is for my little girls? And of course I want to keep my PA safe, but I don't know where to get this stuff from and I haven't got the extra funds to buy it. I mean, apparently people on direct payments were supposed to be given contingency money to pay for PPE, but I haven't been given any, and neither has several people I know who are on the same scheme. We're just kind of sourcing it ourselves little by little on Amazon and eBay.
Well, we did reach out to the Department for Health and Social Care to comment on this issue, and a spokesperson told us, "The government is working around the clock to protect the most vulnerable in our society, and it is vital that personal assistants receive the PPE they need to safely provide care and support. If direct payment holders cannot source PPE as they would normally do, the relevant local authorities or clinical commissioning groups should support them in accessing it using national supply lines." Fee, you mentioned that you use a BiPAP ventilator machine to breathe at night, and I've heard reports of shortages of equipment for these machines. Has this affected you?
Yes, unfortunately it has. I didn't realise it affected me until I rang to try and get some spare supplies, which I normally do every few months, and nobody was answering the phone. I later found out from a friend that goes to the same clinic as me that the clinic had been turned into an ICU for COVID patients. So patients with neuromuscular conditions like myself, who need ventilation and have that sort of, I guess, high need at home, were just left.
So what are you doing with together with the people that you know are also running short? How will you get around this?
We've had no choice really but to establish a Facebook group and kind of put our supplies kind of in a pot, a virtual pot, and try and help each other out by sending bits and bobs back and forth to each other that maybe someone else has, say, got a spare filter, but maybe I've got a spare tube and we swap. Obviously, you know, clean, not used stuff, but, you know, we'll all have different stashes of things, but eventually we won't be able to help ourselves, never mind each other.
Srabaja, you are also in the extremely high-risk category, but you live with your husband and 21-year-old son. So what precautions do you have to take within your own household?
So my son came back from university when they sent all the students home. So we had to self-isolate from each other. And when I see them still, we do keep 2 metres apart, particularly if they have to pop out at all. I'm really confined to the front room, really.
So you all sleep in different rooms?
Yes, yes. And also I have my meals brought to me. I don't go in the kitchen. My husband and I share a bathroom, and luckily my son has his own. So every time we use our bathroom, it's cleaned before the next person needs to use it. So there's a lot of cleaning, a lot of work going on. And I think that's been very challenging, particularly for my husband, because he's also a high-risk person and we're also working. So, you know, it's felt like a lot. It's felt like a lot, I think.
And how has shielding affected the care that you receive?
So I do receive a package as well from the local authority and had a carer. But when the whole thing kicked off, she was also concerned and I was also concerned. We had a chat about the situation, really. And I, with much reluctance, let her go. Because she goes into multiple houses, she travels on public transport, she didn't have PPE, she couldn't get testing, and I just felt that it was making us far too vulnerable for her to come and look after me when we've got 3 people in the house who are all potentially high risk of hospitalisation if we contract COVID. She herself felt it was very difficult as well. And we had quite an emotional parting, actually, where we were both sort of tearful. But, you know, I just felt there was no choice.
And how has that affected things at home for you? You know, how are you managing to get the support you need without her?
Well, I'm very dependent on family, really. And I try to do as much as I can, but I do find it extremely exhausting. So she used to help, you know, with my bathing care and things like that, and I do that alone, but as soon as I've finished I feel like I'm ready for bed again.
Amy, not all disabled women necessarily fall into this high risk category and aren't shielding. You're one of them. You're not shielding, but nevertheless, how have things changed for you at home?
So I'm not shielding. I don't have any underlying health conditions, but I am visually impaired. And I think that there is a large group of disabled people who haven't got these letters, may have health conditions or disabilities that are having a real impact on the way that they are living now. For myself, I've basically lost my independence. I now can't go outside without my sighted partner who lives with me. He's having to do a lot more caring responsibilities around the house and also out and about because I cannot practice social distancing. I can't see 2 metres away. My vision isn't good enough for that. I don't have depth perception. So in the first, you know, early weeks, I did go out by myself, but I found it really challenging people were still walking into me. My cane was making contact with people, which meant that they weren't 2 metres away because my cane is only 125 centimetres long. And I tried to go to the shop and found it really challenging. So I'm feeling quite isolated. It's affecting my mental health quite a lot. I live with anxiety anyway, and this situation makes a lot of that more challenging at the moment.
And you mentioned there about, you know, those people that didn't get that letter. Do you think there has been enough support for those disabled women, including blind and visually impaired women, who aren't vulnerable enough to be on this list, but are nevertheless really struggling to do the weekly shop?
Absolutely. You know, blind and visually impaired people were not recognised early on as people facing particular barriers during this crisis. I have friends that waited 5 weeks to get on online shopping lists when they physically could not access the shops. I think there are a lot of people who will have had some really radical changes to the way that they can be independent and their ability to navigate the world in the way that they are used to doing. So yeah, I think there is a really big forgotten group of people who have a whole host of different barriers and challenges. You know, there's 13.9 million disabled people in the UK, and it's anything from a mobility impairment, meaning a new cycleway is blocking a dropped curb, a new inaccessible shop because you're visually impaired, or somebody who's neurodiverse that is just finding the wealth of information really overwhelming and challenging.
Sarabhajit, because you and your family are shielding, how have you managed with buying and getting food? Did you struggle at all at the start?
So I think the first 3 to 4 weeks, we just managed through a WhatsApp group, through asking neighbours, through sort of asking people if they would mind picking something up from the local shops for us. And, you know, it really made me feel much more disabled than I'd ever felt before. It made me feel very vulnerable. And as a family, you know, it was really challenging because food and shelter are basic needs. So that was very difficult in the beginning. And then when I did get, you know, some volunteers to help, I also had some very mixed experiences of that too. Some were absolutely fantastic and others were not. And then there were some safeguarding issues as well around that and around handing over money and all those kind of things. So it was very, very difficult for the first 3 to 4 weeks.
We're on week 10 now. I'm on week 10. And the other day I was thinking I needed something out of my handbag, and I got my handbag from where I'd left it, which was hanging up on the inside of my front door. And I realised I hadn't opened it in 10 weeks. And it was like looking into a time capsule. I opened it up and I found receipts in there from when I last left the house over 70 days ago, which for me was a trip to B&Q to get some plants. And the receipts I was looking at even had the name of the person who was working on the till. And I thought, God, that might have been the last social interaction I had with someone in the outside world who wasn't my partner.
Yeah, I feel the same about my white cane. You know, my white cane is hanging up on my coat rack, and normally it's in my hand every single day. Every single day when I'm travelling into central London, when I'm on the tube, when I'm going shopping, it's like an extension of me. And I know people who use mobility aids will be very familiar with that. And you know, I am using it occasionally when I do leave the house, because I have the privilege of being able to leave the house, albeit not on my own. And it's a skill set, you know, using a white cane. I had to learn how to use my white cane. I had to take lessons, and I'd only started using it 3 years ago, and I was finally feeling that I'd really, you know, nailed it. I'd really got this independence, and I'm worried I'm going to lose those skills, because going out by myself and using the skills that kept me independent, it's just so anxiety inducing. I find myself not wanting to go out, and I'm worried that's going to become a long-term problem, that I'm just going to be so overwhelmed by the prospect of going out and bumping into people and potentially encountering hostile interactions.
Fee, you're a mother to 2 very young children, 4 and 7. How have you juggled these additional asks and responsibilities?
I found it in the early days, it was going quite well the first 2 weeks. We seemed to get into a routine with homeschool and things while I was trying to juggle the PPE situation. But then as I realised how full-on homeschooling is when you have a disability as well, I suffer with chronic pain and fatigue. So there would be days where I just couldn't do the homeschool, and that made me feel like I'd failed. And the children, when I kind of go downhill, that kind of takes them out of their routine, and it's like a domino effect.
I mean, do they understand what's going on? How do you explain this strange situation to them?
My oldest seems like she understands 1 minute. But then I think when she's struggling emotionally to deal with what, you know, how she's taking everything to do with her, she realises how isolated we've all become. So, like, when my husband takes them out on the daily walk, she'll keep asking me, "Are you coming this time, Mummy?" And I'm like, I'm sorry, darling, it's not been 12 weeks yet. And she's like, "Why do you have to stay in?" And then I kind of have to have that really awful conversation about how what COVID-19 would possibly do to me. And I have to describe it in an age-appropriate way that's not going to scare her, but is going to make her realise that I need to be shielded.
Amy, you mentioned about how you're having to sort of depend a bit more on your partner. You certainly can't leave the house now without him. How has that impacted upon the dynamics there of your relationship and gender roles? You know, what has changed there?
It feels very frustrating. Obviously, my partner is lovely and I love him very much, and he's very good and supportive. You know, when I first lost a little bit more vision, he even did some training how to guide me safely. He is the best person to do it. But, you know, it makes me feel so much less independent and so reliant. And a lot of my identity is about, you know, being an adult and being an adult that goes out the house to work. And yes, you know, being a blind person navigating the tube, that's really hard. But there is such a satisfaction in completing that journey to work every day and feeling like I participate in society and that I'm, you know, a valuable member of society. You know, I have friends and hobbies, and I'm a member of the Women's Institute, and, like, you know, I do volunteering. And it's just taking quite a toll on me, and it is reminding me of more difficult periods in my life when I was feeling very isolated, when I wasn't leaving the house because of mental health issues. And I'm trying to be very aware of that, because those things could resurface and really affect my well-being. And, you know, like we said, it could slow down that transition back to normal life.
And Sarah Bajaya, you said there that you're not able to be in the same room, really, or stay. You have to physically stay very away from your husband and son. I imagine that means you won't have been able to hug them in this time, and not being able to properly spend time with them. How has that impacted your relationships as a mother and a wife?
Yes, that's right. I mean, we haven't hugged. We sort of do virtual hugs across the room, that kind of thing. And I do say, oh, let's break it and, you know, just do it. But they're very strict about it, because obviously they're worried as to how it will impact my health. It's not me. I'm a very cuddly person. You know, I miss it so much.
I really relate to what you were saying about, you know, sort of really wanting to break the rules, and then having, you said your husband and son are like, no, you know, and being more strict about it. There have been so many times where I've been sort of gazing out my window and I've just said, oh, go on, I'll just go out just for a little one, just a few minutes, go on, I just open the door, or just do a lap around the block, no one will know. And my partner's been like, come on now, come back inside, stay away from the window. But it is, you know, is kind of exercising that self-restraint is incredibly difficult. But Fee, you know, I know very much that having some degree of control and agency over your over your life, over your body, over your care is so important. And I know you've had to make so many changes to how you do things at home. How has this all had an impact on you psychologically, mentally?
The past couple of weeks I've been feeling quite low, to be honest. And anybody who knows me quite well, I'm very optimistic. I used to go out most days in my power chair, and I go up and down the country usually, going to conferences and working with various charities. And not having that kind of escape and that purpose, you know, it all kind of just fell away. And you don't appreciate how being outside really helps your mental health and your happiness until you lose it. So, yeah, I've been trying not to kind of get depressed about the whole situation. But I think it's kind of like moving that light at the end of the tunnel further and further away.
Savajaya, what positives, if any, do you think have come from this period?
Well, there are a few. I'm certainly better connected with my street and my neighbourhood, and have met some fabulous people through who are volunteering for mutual aid groups. So that's been really good. It is very interesting, isn't it, that when we've asked for reasonable adjustments to be able to work from home or do more online work, that disabled people in the past have been told it wasn't really possible or it was very difficult. And it was all possible overnight, really. So I think that people have now understood that it can be done. And so I think that is a very positive thing.
Amy, what about you? What positives do you think have come from this period?
So I would agree. Yeah, I've had some really nice community interactions. You know, we've got to know our neighbours a lot better. The other day, somebody from our street actually banged on the door and said, you know, socially distanced, "Oh, just to let you know, a big branch has come down overnight and it's lying across the pavement here." And that kind of thing would never have happened before. You know, people suddenly being a little bit more aware of some of those challenges that might be out there because they faced some restrictions on their own lives. Now, of course, spending weeks in lockdown is not the equivalent of a disability, but it is giving people a perspective on what it's like to have a barrier to be able to freely choose what you want to do, and that barrier being out of your control. And I've started an online pub for disabled and non-disabled people, and it's called The Staying In with two N's. It's a pun. And it's been amazing. You know, we've had hundreds of people join us. We do all sorts of different sessions. We have a weekly pub quiz. But we're also connecting people and sharing skills. We've had a British Sign Language lesson, and we've actually recently had a disability advocacy session where we're equipping the disabled community with some of those skills and rights that we might need to fight with over the next few months.
And Fee, finally, what positives, if any, do you think have come from this period of time?
I think people, and us included, have become more grateful for our families, for our own health, and for our freedom in general, whether you have a disability or not. And I think, I hope that people will remember this time and what we went through and realise how treasured these things should be and not instantly forget when this is all over.
That report was by Katie Pennick, and there are links for help and advice on the Woman's Hour website. We had a huge amount of response to this discussion on disability and lockdown. Marie said, "This is so powerful. I really feel there are people who have been forgotten during this pandemic." Hannah said, "I just wanted to say thank you for including the piece that just aired on women in lockdown who are disabled. It's nice to know you aren't alone, and I hope as well, as one of the contributors said, that this helps able-bodied people understand our lives. We can never do everything we want to do, and now everyone is in the same boat. I hope that people remember this after COVID." Wales Council of the Blind tweeted to say, Dr. Amy Kavanagh today giving a powerful description of how COVID-19 has affected her as a vision impaired person and taken its toll on her confidence, but has also had some positives. Georgina said, "I am shielded because of lung disease. As soon as the government announced shielding groups were allowed outside, my employer asked when I was coming back to work. Shielding hasn't ended yet." Sue said, "I'm staggered to hear so many vulnerable people shielding and struggling on today's Woman's Hour. When I've had no more than 3 requests to support people after becoming a volunteer on the NHS Royal Voluntary Service since the government request. I'm here and well and available and clearly need to reach out in other ways to support, which I will do. Horrified at the lack of coordination." Nicola said, "My daughter Sophia was diagnosed with MS last year, 3 weeks after her 16th birthday. During her GCSEs, she lost her whole summer and year, having become paralysed, and then a long period of rehabilitation and now lockdown. It's been incredibly challenging shielding a teenager who wants to see friends and get her life back and also manage her care in lockdown. Sophia is a determined young woman and has worked hard to walk fully again, but life has stopped." Rosie said, "Brilliant feature, thank you so much. I particularly related to a lot of what At Blonde Historian said about the worry of losing the skills to navigate the world." Rebecca Nye wrote, "Very pleased to hear your piece on those shielding in the extremely clinically vulnerable group this morning. I am one of these too. But it is important to note that only a proportion of us are disabled. Many are shielding due to medical conditions and or treatment such as cancer, autoimmune disorders or transplant status. I have lupus and lung disease. It would be good to have attention to the non-disabled shielders too." And Susan said, "Today's feature about the very vulnerable in lockdown was interesting and revealing, but excluded a representation of someone in this position but living alone. My close friend has just been through chemotherapy just before lockdown and lives alone. She has no carers, so has relied on friends and her daughter. She's finding it difficult but has taken up painting and is trying to stay positive, which isn't easy. There must be so many others like her." Well, thank you for all your comments on this morning's programme. Do join me tomorrow at 10:03, when I'll be talking to Dr. Helen Chersky about her autopsy of the North Sea, finding out exactly what we human beings have been doing to pollute the seas, not only in the North Sea, but all over the world. That's tomorrow morning. Join me then if you can. Bye-bye.
Hello, I'm Tim Harford, the presenter of More or Less. And I believe that if you want to understand the world, which is a very big, very complicated place, then numbers are an absolutely essential tool. They're like a telescope for an astronomer or an X-ray machine for a radiographer. Numbers answer questions we can't answer in any other way, such as, how safe is a home birth? And yes, we check the facts. What are those lying politicians lying to us about this week? So please subscribe to More or Less and let numbers light up your world.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
What is wellness?
I think of the image of wellness as like pure joy.
The important thing is for people to choose, like, what do you want to do?
Wellness are the things your grandmother told you to do.
When you really start to think about it, the answer feels more complicated.
I'm Maya Feller, registered dietitian nutritionist and author.
And I'm Dr. Kavita Patel. We're the hosts of Well Now, Slate's new podcast on wellness.
Join us every Wednesday as we tackle that simple yet important question, what does it mean to be well?